Welcome to the deep dive. You know that feeling, right? Just drowning in information articles, endless discussions online, your own notes even. It's like this huge, sometimes chaotic sea of data.
Yeah, it really is.
So our mission today is to dive into this really fascinating collection of sources you've shared with us.
Mm-hmm.
We want to pull out the key nuggets, the most important bits of knowledge and insight. Basically, a shortcut to getting up to speed.
And this deep dive, it's really about exploring how we grapple with some fundamental questions, you know, like what actually defines quality? What do we count as truth? And how do we even build community when the world's just overflowing with subjective experiences?
Exactly.
From like the tiny details in music and art all the way to the, well, the wild west of online interactions. We'll look at that tension, that pull between personal taste and objective analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And also the really surprising ways human expression just kind of manifests when you give it a platform.
Okay, so get ready to hear how people really wrestle with defining what's good in music, what makes an online community actually work or, you know, spectacularly fall apart.
Right.
And even how creators themselves deal with the challenges of their own stories, their own narratives. We're about to unpack some truly intriguing perspectives here.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's start by jumping right into the deep end. The incredibly personal, sometimes baffling world of art and music.
Yeah.
Our sources really lay bare this fascinating struggle, trying to define what's good when, honestly, everyone's ear hears something different, everyone's eye sees something else.
It's really striking how some of the sources talk about extreme music, for instance. They describe it as this hazy, nauseating miasma.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, and what one person thinks is basically the same can be, like, radically different to someone else. And the other way around, too.
So completely subjective.
Totally. It highlights what the sources call a feels over reels approach. It's all about the feeling, the vibe, where the exact timbre, you know, that unique sound quality, that's paramount.
Right.
It really makes you wonder, are we even listening to the same song sometimes? When the difference between good and great might just be some tiny, incredibly subjective sonic detail.
Like those tiny little things.
Exactly. One source even mentions a listener specifically asking for all of the squealies.
The squealies.
Yeah, those high-pitched, like, distorted guitar sounds. It just shows how specific that desire for unique particular elements can get.
That makes so much sense when you look at some of the specific music examples you pulled from the sources.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Kate.
Oh, yeah, Kate. They're described as, like, accessible black metal mixed with ambient. But what's surprising is the gothic and symphonic stuff in there.
So not what you'd immediately expect.
Not at all. It kind of challenges that idea that black metal has to be purely grim or difficult. You know, it gets praised for good mixing, drums that are crisp, flat, and snappy.
Okay, technical praise too.
Yeah, and fetting vocal fry screams, that low kind of guttural style. And apparently the music flows so well, it actually benefits from the album listening experience.
Ah, so it works as a whole piece.
Right, which shows that even accessible music can be, you know, deeply appreciated by people really into the genre.
Okay, interesting. And then there's Trey.
Trey, yeah. This band gets credit for doing something unique that was hard to pull off. But then, the imitations.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, the sources call them poseurs, you know, people seen as faking it, and say their attempts are just embarrassing.
Ouch.
And interestingly, the source mentions Trey was actually a local act. From Texas and Mexico City. Adds a bit of regional flavor to their uniqueness.
Huh. And Fist in Fetus, that name.
Yeah, it's grindcore, super fast, aggressive stuff. But this EP gets commended for having competent compositions. It even has symphonic bits and jazzy bits.
The grindcore.
Apparently described as delicious flourishes, so it feels like real music, not just, you know, a gimmick.
Okay, so what these examples seem to show is this frustration, this... What do the sources call it? The anti-label dregs.
Exactly. It's this real need people have for precise categories. Just saying something has gnarly head-banging riffs for black metal, that doesn't cut it.
Not specific enough.
Right. Listeners want to know, is it first wave, cold, black metal, you know, the raw atmospheric kind, or is it second wave, actually good, which implies maybe something more developed, melodic, even symphonic?
So actually good is a subjective judgment baked right into the label attempt.
Pretty much. And there's this big divide in metal, apparently, between people who like epic sounds and those who prefer intense sounds. And the current genre tags, they often just fail to capture those crucial differences.
It's a fascinating clash, isn't it? Our need to sort things, versus how fluid art actually is.
Totally. And it's not just music. This stretches into other media, too.
Right.
The sources get critical about certain high-concept horror allegories in movies.
Like which ones?
They use Ex Machina and Companion as examples. The argument presented is that these films, you know, despite their big ideas, they kind of fall apart under scrutiny, meaning they're seen less as exploring universal truths and more about, well, the sources use some pretty charged terms like GRRRL, a power, or choice feminism.
Okay, so a critique of the perceived message.
Right. And the view in these sources is that this focus ultimately airbrushes the correlation of whatever social critique they might have been aiming for. We're just reporting what the sources say here, of course.
Got it. So it's about whether the message maybe takes over the art or if the message itself feels flimsy.
Something like that. And our sources also bring up Junji Ito, the famous horror artist.
Oh, yeah. Everyone knows his style.
Visually, yes. He's recognized as a skilled artist. Mm-hmm. But the critique in the source material is that he's not necessarily a skilled horror writer.
Interesting distinction.
Yeah, the claim is his grotesqueries are ultimately pretty doldrum, meaning the horrific images can feel repetitive or maybe lack deeper narrative punch. The source argues he creates horror for those who don't want to be disturbed, especially when you compare him to someone like Sihiro, who is cited as being more genuinely unsettling.
Wow, okay. That's a strong take.
It is. And what really stands out from all this is how often art gets judged, not just on its own merits, you know, the craft, the aesthetics, but on its perceived intentions or its social commentary.
Whether the artist meant it that way or not.
Exactly. It really begs the question, how much does the artist's message end up dictating the art's quality, especially when that message is maybe ambiguous or perhaps not even what the audience is looking for?
That's a great point. Mm-hmm. And speaking of subjective experiences and, well, how we express them. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about the fascinating, often really messy world of online communities.
Oh, yeah. The digital agora.
Right. Our sources give us this raw, unfiltered look at how people interact, how they express themselves, and how they try to build these shared digital spaces.
Or tear them down.
Or tear them down, yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely this clear yearning you see in the sources for, like, small solve-valial websites with distinct communities.
Right, like an antidote to the big platforms.
Exactly. A counter to the consolidation of the web, as they put it. But actually building and maintaining these smaller spaces, that's loaded with tension, especially around moderation.
Ah, the mods. Always tricky.
Totally. Discussions highlight the challenge of rules feeling arbitrary or the potential for power-tripping jannies. That's slang for moderators seen as abusing their power.
Yeah, I've seen that term.
So there's this constant debate, right, between carefully cultivating and protecting a certain tone for the community.
Versus just letting it all hang out.
Exactly. And the sources point out that any ban over inconsequential material is going to paint a bad picture of the place. Makes sense.
Sure does.
But they also suggest that maybe stricter moderation, no image dumping or porn either, is probably what would make this bad idea last longer. So a sense that maybe clearer rules, stricter boundaries might actually help these places survive.
It sounds like a real tightrope walk. One source even calls online thread culture broth.
Bra.
Yeah, like a reflection of the ego of the poster, where the amount of freedom you're given to post whatever you want, that's what shapes the whole vibe, the whole environment.
Huh. That's evocative. And within these spaces, self-expression is nonstop, right? But what's it actually communicating?
Good question.
Take fashion or body modifications. Our sources talk about these not just as personal choices, but as types of social signaling.
Right, sending messages.
Yeah. Some see it as like angsty, explosive releases of emotion or maybe reclaiming one's body. But other sources are way more critical. They call it narcissism or a beauty Ponzi scheme. Like you're constantly investing in appearance just to keep up. Or they use really dismissive language like clown makeup or criticizing fake trends.
Wow, quite the range of opinions.
Definitely. And it raises this fascinating question. In a world where how you present yourself is under such a microscope, can you actually opt out of that whole social language of fashion? Is that even possible?
It feels like you're always signaling something, whether you mean to or not.
Probably. But then how do you figure out what's sincere in all that constant signaling?
Good point.
The sources even get into the lolcow phenomenon.
Ah, yes. Explain that for people who might not know.
It's a term often used pretty cruelly online for individuals who, whether they mean to or not, become targets of intense mockery and ridicule, often because they seem to continuously feed the haters, maybe actively and purposefully invite bullying, perhaps for attention.
Right. It's a really unpleasant corner of the internet.
Extremely. And it creates an environment the sources describe as deeply unserious, where doing things for the lulz, you know, just for laughs, can spiral tragically into more and more horrible things.
That's disturbing.
It really is. And what's striking when you look at all this is how that desire for structure, for meaning in online interactions, just constantly clashes head on with these raw, chaotic, very human tendencies, self-expression, performance. It really highlights that constant push and pull. The individual wanting to be heard versus the community struggling to just hold itself together to maintain some kind of coherence.
That constant tension. Which brings us to another kind of challenge, the act of creation itself. Let's pivot now and talk about the imperfections, the flaws that are just inherent in trying to bring a vision to life.
Right, because even in really complex, celebrated works, things can get messy.
Exactly. Our sources highlight how original ideas can get muddled, leading to outcomes that are unexpected and sometimes pretty heavily criticized.
And we've got a really fascinating case study for this in the webcomic Homestuck.
Ah, Homestuck, known for being intricate.
Intricate is one word for it. Yeah. Incredibly popular online comic, but its sheer complexity, its convoluted narrative led to a lot of criticism about narrative choices, character development, you name it.
Like what specifically?
Well, for instance, the comic's early use of words like retard and autistic. The sources discuss this as potentially a deliberate commentary on how the fandom looks at those words.
Mm.
Like maybe an attempt by the author to show character growth, even if the characters were acting a bit offensive initially. It's debated, obviously.
Sure. What else?
Then there's the time travel. Oh, boy. The time travel.
Uh-oh. Are we tricky?
Totally. The sources break down how Homestuck's time travel mechanics evolved. It apparently started out kind of malleable. You could change things. Then it shifted to doomed timelines that couldn't be changed.
Okay.
And eventually it got to what some sources just call pure hackery with the alpha timeline, where basically everything just conveniently bends to whatever the writer needs at that moment.
So inconsistent.
Yeah. The sources say these different models all kind of exist side by side in disharmony.
Yeah.
Not exactly a smooth system.
Sounds like a narrative headache. And did this affect the characters too?
It seems so. The sources draw parallels to critiques of, say, Persona 4's Naoto Shirogane, a character in that game some felt was rushed and didn't get real development compared to others like Kanji or Rise. Similarly, Homestuck characters are sometimes seen as just floating along into radically different portrayals. There's mention of something called the pogo hammer.
The what?
The pogo hammer. Described as fucking fun, apparently, and its loss marked a downward spiral for the comic, according to this source. So clearly significant.
Right.
But conversely, something called Green's Guns are deemed fucking boring, even though they were power-ups. So felt like wasted potential there.
Huh. So struggles with narrative, with character arcs.
And it's not just narrative. This struggle with design, with vision, it pops up in game mechanics, too.
How so?
Our sources include a really strong critique of Persona 2's combat and summon system.
What's the complaint?
Labeled slow, pointless busy work, even a second job. Apparently due to constant grinding and a really complex system for mixing demons.
Oof, sounds frustrating.
Yeah, it highlights how overly complex mechanics can just kill the fun for a player, right?
Yeah.
Turns the game into a chore. And another point the sources make is how games that aren't primarily puzzle games often just throw in these really basic low-hanging fruit puzzles.
Like what?
Like Sokoban block-pushing puzzles or those ice puzzles where you slide around.
Oh, yeah, those.
The argument is they just serve to pad out otherwise bland dungeons. They don't really enhance the gameplay. They're just filler. Feels like a lack of innovative design.
It's really insightful, actually, seeing how often creators, even with these grand ambitions, kind of stumble into similar traps.
Yeah, whether it's the story getting tangled or the game mechanics feeling like a slog, or even this perception that the author's own political morals might have shifted during creation.
Right.
The sources reveal this common thread, don't they? The sheer challenge of keeping a vision coherent when you're juggling complexity, what the audience expects, and your own artistic goals.
Absolutely. And it also touches on that surprising idea from the sources.
Oh, you mean the one about reverse psychology?
Yeah, that reverse psychology actually works. And all you have to do to make someone do whatever you want is annoy them and be quotable.
Huh. Well, that's certainly a take. Maybe a bit cynical.
Maybe. But it speaks to the weird ways influence can work, I suppose.
It does.
So, wow. From the really subjective depths of music taste, through the intricate and often messy dynamics of online communities, right up to the challenges creators face, today's deep dive has really unpacked a lot.
It really has.
Just how we humans try to make sense of everything, how we operate in this world just saturated with information and, well, individual experience.
And I think we've seen that things like truth and quality, they aren't always fixed points, are they? They're often kind of co-created through interaction, through interpretation.
Yeah, negotiated almost.
Exactly. There's this constant negotiation between what we perceive, what we value, and what we choose to put out there to express.
Mm-hmm.
And the sources really highlight that sometimes, you know, despite our best intentions, things just get messy. They get contradictory or just plain frustrating.
But maybe. Maybe that's the point. Maybe instead of trying to fight all that chaos, our deep dive into all this human-generated stuff, maybe it isn't about finding perfect, neat answers.
What then?
Maybe it's more about appreciating the tapestry. You know, the rich, often contradictory, totally complex tapestry of human expression itself.
That's a really nice way to put it. And it leads to an important final thought, maybe something for you, the listener, to consider.
Right.
In this age where self-improvement is pushed everywhere, but as one source provocatively puts it, they don't want you to self-improve.
Right, that quote.
What does it actually mean to truly gain knowledge, to gain insight, when the very landscape of information is constantly shifting and when it's always in some way reflecting our own subjective biases right back at us? How do you navigate that?